To item number five, the Regional Fish Enhancement Group's briefing. We have Dave Price, our Restoration Division Manager, and our guest, Colleen Thompson. We have some others. Dave, are you going to introduce our guests?
Yes, ma'am, I will.
Great.
Madam Chair Wecker, members of the Commission, Director Anderson, Deputy Director Storr, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is David Price. I'm the Restoration Division Manager, which is in the Habitat Program. And in the Restoration Division, we manage the Regional Fish Enhancement Group. We administer the Regional Fish Enhancement Group. With me today is Colleen Thompson, the Executive Director of the Regional Fisheries Enhancement Group Coalition. Larry Zelaznik, Tri-State Steelheaders Board Member. Lance Winnica, South Puget Sound Salmon Enhancement Group. Jason Lundgren, who is here from the Upper Columbia Regional Fish Enhancement Group, Cascadia Fish Enhancement Group. I intend to be brief. I understand you guys are past due, and this is mostly the Regional Fish Enhancement Group meeting. The Regional Fish Enhancement Group has been with us for about 24 years. It's a very successful and a very efficient partner in restoration of aquatic systems, specifically for salmon and steelhead. And I'm going to let them talk a little bit more about their program, both in terms of success and challenges.
My name is Colleen Thompson, and I'm the new managing director of the coalition. I just wanted a chance to introduce myself. The coalition's really looking forward to the opportunity of giving you a briefing about the good work that we're doing. And I'll turn this over to Larry Zelaznik to tell you to start the presentation. Thank you for having us here. We really appreciate it.
I've been involved with the Regional Fisheries Enhancement Group Tri-State Steelheaders was added in Southeast Washington in 2002, I believe, and the Upper Columbia group was added at the time, and then I was the RFEG Coalition, which is a representation for the 14 groups. I was the initial president, and I'm the current president. Aspect of the RFEG program that's different than anything else in the state is the fact that we're using local volunteers. We have local landowners that support the activities of the groups all across the 14 regions. The only area in the state that doesn't have an RFEG group is Northeast Washington, the Spokane area, because of the lack of anadromous fish in that area. The groups are able to leverage the funds that they receive from the state and federal government on an average of 8-1. The state funds, neither the state nor the federal funds are what we would consider stable. Federal money, we're worried about disappearing roughly $1.5 million or $1.1 million, which would be a major hit to the RFEG program. And then state funds are tied to license fees and excess carcass and roe sales from the general fund hatcheries. The hatchery numbers that come back as surplus fish fluctuate on an annual basis, and potential budget cuts in the general fund in the state of Washington that would reduce hatchery production would affect license sales. So there's that uncertainty in even the state funding side. But the kinds of work that the RFEG program completes is outreach and education, habitat, things that WDFW assists us with, but really we do the work on the ground. It's been a long-term partnership. The leverage, the amount of increased habitat over the years and on an annual basis, the volunteer hours, the communities that are involved, the education and outreach, the children that are working, planting, understanding the life cycles of the anadromous fish is it's a great asset to the population of the people in Washington State. The there's just a myriad of benefits that accrue. We've got local contractors that are busy working, engineers that are working for the RFEGs on the myriad of programs. So there's an economic benefit. Most of the communities that the RFEGs are based in are small towns. So hiring local contractors and engineers adds greatly to the relationship economically that we have in our communities. The projects that have been completed, the staff time, these numbers change. 187 FTEs, and this, as with any payroll, changes take place daily. 53 staff, Conservation Corps, professional construction services, roughly 112 engineers, surveyors, scientists. Roughly $6 million a year goes on the ground, 100,000 hours annually of construction activity. Our passage activities are scattered generally all across the state, except for, again, Northeast Washington, the Spokane area that doesn't have anadromous fish. The Puget Sound, which was the initial home of the RFEG program prior to the expansion into Southeast Washington and the Upper Columbia, and the opportunities that are in the Puget Sound region, that's why there's such a concentration of passage projects in that area. The my involvement, being from I'm the board president for Tri-State Steelheaders in Walla Walla, and so I don't know if many of you have been to Walla Walla, but if you've seen that channel that runs through town, which is Mill Creek, which actually carries anadromous fish, you look at it and it looks like a flume. Floods in 1931 and devastated downtown Walla Walla, there was a hue and a cry for the Army Corps to come in and do a flood project, which they did with no engineering for passage for fish. And with the ESA listing for the Columbian Snake River steelhead salmon, we're working on trying to come up with an approach to better pass fish through the concrete flume. There was a study done on Mill Creek, a Mill Creek assessment that looked at flows, turbulence, species, size of fish that we were engineering for, which was juvenile bull trout, since they were the most vulnerable species in the channel. Resting areas were missing. The fish couldn't, in certain flows, couldn't migrate through because they were spent. They didn't have a place to stop and rest. There was a model built through existing science. It was called an energetics model, where we looked at how far could a fish move under certain flows before it became tired and had to stop. And so we put those resting pools, roughen the surface, and we had to do this underneath the umbrella of, it was a flood control project, Corps plus county. Whatever we did in the channel could not reduce the flood flows. And so after it was all engineered, there was a model built, a scale model. Water was run through it. Different pool sizes were looked at, and the big thing were the flood flows, so that we didn't impede or back up any water. After the engineering model was looked at, the flood flows were actually increased. We had better flow through that channel and still had habitat being put in for fish. The ESA, there was actually 12 different reaches as far as an engineering standpoint through that channel. There's 12 distinct types of channel or reaches that have been engineered for fish passage. To date, we've completed about 600 feet out of 10,400 feet of impaired channel, or about 6%. On the drawing boards next year, if we get funding, we'll be up to about 16 to 18%. It is a multi-year project. It's probably going to be another 10 or 12 years before we address the whole channel. But the delisting process is not just numbers. It's not just, if you hit 1,000 fish back, we're going to delist the the steelhead. It's spatial distribution, and the spatial distribution in because of the Mill Creek is a tributary, the Walla Walla, which the Touche is a tributary, the Walla Walla. So we've got this. These fish have to be able to distribute themselves within their historic ranges. And especially with the bull trout, with the genetic mixing that's historically taken place where they'll tail down in high water, come down the Mill Creek, go up the Walla Walla, tail down, go up the Touche, they'll stick around, they'll mix genetically, and a more viable species. And the lack of passage, not just up but down, to get the bull trout mixing again. We're hoping that we'll have a delisted species in my lifetime, and the irrigators would be very happy to have the delisting. But it is a high priority under the ESA. But say it's one of the projects that we've partnered with the BPA, the Umatilla Tribe Surf Board. So there's a lot of partnering with the Tri-State Steelheaders to get this thing moved forward. And
Jason. Hello, my name is Jason Lundgren. I'm the director of the Cascade Columbia Fisheries Enhancement Group. I recognize that's a mouthful and it typically gets jumbled. I'm used to that. But thank you very much for having us today. It's a great opportunity to be in front of you. I think it was about 2 years ago that we last sat in front of you, and I think there's been a little bit of turnover on the commission. So we want to put ourselves front and center as much as we can because we consider ourselves a very valuable appendage of the department, and the relationship that we have had over the past 20 years continues to be pretty productive and evolving as the needs of the department as well as the fish change. So I'm going to talk about a few types of projects that we conduct as 14 independent nonprofits across the state. The Regional Fisheries Enhancement Group program fulfills a very, very broad at times salmon recovery niche across the state, including education, which Lance will talk about. And I know that when we presented to you 2 years ago, that sparked a certain interest with some of you. We conduct a wide range of projects, both in project type, geography, and the scope. And you'll see a couple of examples. This PowerPoint's pretty short, but I want to touch on the different types of projects that we do. So, generally speaking, the Regional Fisheries Enhancement Groups, we follow the WACs that created us to recover these species. But more specifically, by watershed, we follow in watersheds with endangered species, as Larry and I live in. We follow these salmon recovery plans that I'm sure many of you are aware of. They are created locally and adopted by the federal government at various points in time, and they lay out sort of the broad framework for how we invest our time and money to recover ESA-listed fish. For areas like some areas on the coast that don't have ESA, you know, let's hope that they don't, they have salmon recovery strategies of some kind. They're, again, locally developed with a broad range of partners. So the reason I'm talking about this is that's sort of the overall framework. And then when you get into the salmon recovery regions, we look at first, like in the Upper Columbia, for example, we look at a tributary scale. So that's sort of the 50,000-foot level, tributary being like the Wenatchee. It's a tributary of the Columbia. On the west side, you wouldn't consider that size of river a tributary except for the Puget Sound. But so we first look at the tributary, which might look at 50 miles of a river, and we understand the geologic processes, the hydrology, some of the habitat factors, and we narrow it down over time. So an example of this is these two slides represent some deliverables from a tributary assessment that was conducted a couple of years ago by the Bureau of Reclamation. And so we're mapping floodplain features, including a prominent state highway, private land ownership, areas of inundation, and habitat factors affecting ESA-listed fish. So once that's been conducted, we can narrow it down into a reach scale. And from there, you go down to the project scale. And the reason I think that this is important is because these projects, they're not sexy construction projects. You don't do press releases about these types of projects, and they can often be hard to sell to funders. But I think the reason it's important to talk about these kinds of things is that I think historically we collectively did salmon recovery on a very opportunistic basis, and to some degree that still happens today. But for the most part, where we are now with the fewer resources and kind of the low-hanging fruit being done is we're having to put a lot of thought and energy into the projects that we select. And so I think that's an important thing for all of you at your level that, you know, generally when you see one of these projects in the paper or you hear about it at a meeting, there may have been several years that have gone into the identification and development of that project. So I wanted to show some examples of typical types of projects that we do, and I think Larry mentioned one of the unique things about the RFEGs is that we really do try to stay local and work with volunteers as much as we can. With those large, complicated projects, those opportunities become limited, but we do try to find those opportunities as much as we can. Driscoll Island, just south of Oroville, is actually department-owned land, and it was purchased for goose migration and feeding habitat in the 70s. I forget, it might have been a Magnuson Act or something like that. But this stretch of the Okanagan is extremely warm, and salmonids have a difficult time surviving. So restoring the riparian vegetation that's been eliminated over the past century is a very important facet of the landscape. So we planted between those yellow arrows. We've got WDFW staff actively involved, the land managers, and we also have a volunteer down the lower left corner. He was completing his master hunter requirements for volunteering. So, you know, like I said, we try to plug in volunteers wherever we can. The upper right-hand corner is in Raleigh's backyard. That's Clear Creek. And, you know, it's a pretty good turnout for a volunteer event when it's, you know, 29 degrees, snowy, slushy, and this group is a combination of, there's the Plain Fly Tires out of Plain, Washington. There's some Trout Unlimited guys there. Basically, local volunteers coming together on a weekend to plant a section of creek that has ESA steelhead in it. So, you know, we feel good about plugging in the community because it gives them a sense of ownership for their watershed. The bottom right is an example where we worked with a local land trust. They purchased some conservation easements similar to the projects that Mr. Budd presented about. And it was funded by the Salmon Recovery Funding Board, but part of the property had been grazed for decades. So, again, restoring riparian vegetation was an important part. Next one. This is something most of you are probably familiar with, the concept of replacing nutrients in watersheds to stimulate primary productivity for juvenile fish. This is something that I've been working on for about 4 years in our watershed, and I think we're getting close to getting permitting. But just to give you an idea, there's a lot of thought put into these projects and a lot of hoops that you need to jump through and justifications that you need to provide. But through the process of getting these projects going, telling the story of why we're doing this stuff to the public is incredibly important, you being part of the public as well. So in the Columbia drainage, we estimate that there are 10 to 16 million adult salmon returning to spawn annually pre-European settlement. Now we hover around 1 million. So most scientists know, and I think most fishermen know too, that those marine subsidies that are coming back to the watershed are nearly gone. And we see that when we measure periphyton and macroinvertebrates and phosphorus and nitrogen in these watersheds. I mean, we want clean water and we strive to have clean water, but sterile water isn't necessarily good for aquatic life. So this is, you know, telling that story of why we would want to do something is really important. And nutrient enhancement is one of the things that, one of the tools in the box, I guess, if you will. So, that wraps up my portion, but thank you very much for your attention. And I'm going to pass it over to Lance.
Thanks. So we're going to go ahead and transition into more of a community outreach and education component of the RFG program. My name is Lance Winnicombe, the Executive Director of the South Puget Sound Salmon Enhancement Group based here in Olympia, Washington. And I wanted to highlight just a couple different projects that are going on from the RFG program side of things. Each 14 group has their own keynote projects that they do in their own watersheds, but I just wanted to highlight two extraordinary good projects that are being undertaken yearly. The first one is the Kennedy Creek Salmon Trail based on Highway 101 between Olympia and Shelton. And I just wanted to highlight this because this is an ongoing project since 1999, and it has an excellent relationship with the Taylor Shellfish Farms. Mm-hmm. The Taylor's family actually owns the property, and the South Sound Group has signed a 20-year lease from Bill Taylor to operate the Salmon Enhancement Trail that operates each November. Every fourth grader in the city of Olympia attends this trail as part of their environmental curriculum, and 2,000 other students attend this trail as well. We get 40 to 50 volunteers each year to volunteer during the week to lead school trips and also to participate during the weekend to the citizens of the region. And I wanted to highlight that the project was highlighted in the National Geographic magazine in 2009, which is kind of a unique feat. And when my board was like, hey, that's a great job. Now what are you going to do? What's your next advertising going to be? And I was like, well, the National Geographic's pretty has a pretty lofty goal to have. This trail is so successful because of Kennedy Creek itself. Kennedy Creek has about anywhere from 20 to 70,000 fish in a 3-mile-long stream. So it is a wonderful opportunity for students in the community to observe naturally spawning salmon in a local watershed. Again, this is a well-thought-out trail that has ADA access for half of the trail. Again, there's platforms, there's bridges. There's a lot of education events that go on throughout the season, which, again, is every November. On the bottom left there, there's myself providing students an insight to the spawning behavior they're going to see in just a couple minutes down the trail. The picture to the upper left is a viewpoint of Kennedy Creek Salmon Trail, and that's just a quick representation of all the kids that visit the trail. Again, it's what makes this trail unique is the unique viewing opportunities of the watershed. There's Kennedy Creek itself, but there's also a creek called Fiscus Creek that is a tributary to Kennedy Creek. And once the flows come up in November, when you can't observe fish in Kennedy Creek, you can very clearly see them in Fiscus Creek, and it really provides a unique opportunity throughout the entire flood cycle for salmon viewing. That makes it a little different than the other salmon viewing in the region. Again, there's signage all throughout the trail. There's 11 nodes of education that tells a different story of the salmon life cycle and the salmon need for survival and some of the threats that face salmon. And again, there's a beautiful bridge, Alaska Yellow Cedar, that's over Fiscus Creek. This is actually named after Jeff Cederholm from the Department of Natural Resources and the Evergreen State College. Many of my peers studied from Jeff Cederholm, and he used Kennedy Creek as his classroom all throughout the Evergreen experience. And again, the picture on the bottom left is just a beautiful male chum salmon that is very easily identified on this wonderful spawning trail. And I wanted to highlight one thing, that this trail is almost self-sufficient from a funding perspective. We do receive a lot of public donations to keep this trail available to the community. We also receive funds from Taylor Shellfish and from the Squaxin Island Tribe, and also some of our RFEG funds through the South Puget Sound Salmon Enhancement Group. So that's one type of project that's ongoing. Another one is called the Citizen Action Teaching School, or cutely called CATS program. This is a program that originated about 20 years ago from the Puget Sound Action Team, and it's been reintroduced by the Puget Sound Partnership. There's 7 RFEGs that are located in the Puget Sound region, and the Nooksack Group has taken the lead on this project, with the other 6 groups contributing to the project. We did receive a competitive grant from the Puget Sound Partnership to reactivate this program, and we successfully completed the first 2 training sessions. One was the Nooksack, and the Olympia area was the first ones that were undertaken, and the Seattle region is happening right now with graduation this June. And then the next 2 cycles are going to be coming up this fall. This program is going to engage and empower local citizens to be more involved in their local communities with water quality and salmon enhancement efforts. And it's trying to teach people how and what to say with public leaders and with their community to create a positive impact in their local communities. Again, just to highlight that there's anywhere from 20 to 30 different people in each one of these classes or sessions, and they're taught by local and regional experts that come to the classes, and they provide just a wonderful opportunity for education. We talk about how to be a local advocate for salmon or water quality, how to get involved in the local community. And the thing that sets this project apart from the other projects is it's not just going to plant trees, or it's not just attending an event. The goal for these people participating is to come up with a unique idea that's self-sustainable, that's going to endure year after year, and to come up with a legacy-type project that is going to provide a long-term benefit for the community. It's not just a one-time event. The goal is to have 30 people in each class just expand their knowledge to many more people within the community. And we're meeting with the partnership, and it sounds like we're going to be able to expand these classes to more areas. And this is open to every citizen in the Puget Sound region. Again, we've done a tremendous amount of outreach to the people that are interested in this type of program. They have every opportunity to be involved in different regions throughout the state and in different times throughout the state. And with that, those were just two. Again, there's many more projects that the RFG program is involved with. These were just two kind of highlight projects that we wanted to share with you about citizen involvement and with trying to educate as many students as possible. And with that, we would all be happy to take any questions if there was any.
Questions? Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I lost your name there, but a great presentation, and I commend the efforts of the enhancement groups across the state. I live in Skagit Valley, and I'm quite familiar with what goes on there. My question is, I believe you said that some of the funding for the organization comes from surplus hatchery sales. I'd like to know your opinion, because recently I've been getting a lot of emails and calls about those sales versus putting those carcasses in streams for at a nutritional base in the streams. I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
The quality of the carcass is actually what determines its disposition. The Department of Fish and Wildlife floats a contract or an RFP request for a proposal to handle these fish. And the contract had been floated on a 5-year term, and it's down to a 2-year term currently. The contractor goes in, picks up the fish, makes a determination on quality. There's a large portion of fish that go to Northwest Harvest food banks, and so the high-quality carcasses, the males will go Northwest Harvest, the females. Normally the RFEG program, we're looking at females, and the eggs are truly where the majority of the value is in the roe. In low quality fish, if they've depending on how low of a quality, some of them end up in the landfill, and low quality fish going into the analogs. Part of the contract, the contractor is supposed to provide a poundage of analogs annually, which are the pellets that are the pasteurized pellets that are thrown or tossed into the creeks for the nutrient enhancement. So the disposition of those carcasses is pretty well set through tradition, I guess. And
so we're putting the pellets in for nutrition versus the carcasses. I might
correct, and because of pathological problems, because right. The fish would have to be tested. The analogs are pasteurized, so they can be planted anywhere, versus fish that might have some pathological issues that would have to go back into the exact same, sure. Maybe not even allowed back into right. The same watershed.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Did you have something to add?
Some parts of the state, there's a more active nutrient enhancement program, Lower Columbia being one of them. There's some nutrient enhancement going on in the Chehalis and along the Pacific Coast. That's sort of the flexibility of these groups sort of depends on the needs of the watershed. So I would say depending on where you are, there may or may not be an active program, but it's definitely one of the priorities as part of the state's contract to dispose of salmon.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. In a world of anger and frustration and polarization, it's refreshing to have you guys come before us, because you epitomize, I think, a higher level of partnership, collaboration, education, research, citizen science, and I think it's we benefit greatly from around the state. Also, you stretch $1 10 different ways, and our allies to us and the department, but also for the citizens of the state. So I just wanted to congratulate you all and thank you for coming.
Any other questions? Well, let me ask you, can you give us a sense of the budget trends lately? How's your budget doing? See any problems on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting used to living with some level of uncertainty, as all of us are, I think. You know, we had a big bump from the surplus salmon contract. We changed, or the department changed, how they let that contract and manage it. So we saw a huge increase from salmon carcass and egg revenue. Licenses have been relatively flat, but we've been told for 5 or more years that our federal funding, this is the last year you're getting the federal funding. So we live with that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And while we carry a little bit of a balance forward just so we don't have to close shop every year, you know, we try to be as flexible as we can, but we're expecting more challenges ahead. And we've been working closely with WDFW on finding alternatives and maybe more sustainable mm-hmm. long-term funding. That's been something we've worked on a lot the last mm-hmm. couple of years. But we've seen small increases in our federal funding. We've seen an increase in our egg and carcass, but we're expecting a precipice, you know, coming up any time.
Is there any state general funds that go into?
No, and we had a budget proviso last year's session. We worked with the agency. We're looking mm-hmm. at, and actually the RFEG Coalition had worked probably 3 years prior to the budget proviso, looking at sustainable funding sources. And, you know, so we've been working on this topic for a while because of the warning that the federal money was going to disappear. And the budget proviso was approved last session, and in working with the agency, it's just very difficult to come up with to replace $1.2 million, mm-hmm. which on the federal side, they call it lint. It's not even, it's a rounding error in their checkbook. So it's not a lot of money, but to us it is. And so it's really difficult. It's, you know, like an opt-in on your fishing license or your hunting license purchase as an option. Well, like on the State Parks Department, where they have the opt-in when you buy your tabs for your auto license, Department of Licensing, you know, it might produce $20,000. And so we're probably not going to have one thing that's going to replace the $1.2 million. And so we've got, you know, like we've got some ideas, but we also have, you know, anytime when you go out, as the agency will well knows, anytime you try to raise a fee, you've got stakeholders that are going to oppose you. And so we've got a lot of work yet ahead of us to try to come up with funding.
So the funding primarily from the department, there's the federal funding flows through the department, so we will get a federal appropriation. And then, as these folks said, the egg and carcass sales has been a recent strong, I think, revenue source, and license sales has traditionally been what's flowed through to the RFEGs. And you'll see tomorrow in the budget presentation how we're thinking about, you know, staying connected to the RFEGs and trying to provide some level of partnership on exploring revenue possibilities. I'm going to break out of this meeting this afternoon and have that discussion. We're trying to keep connected. We're trying to keep the partnership in place. I think funding has been one of the challenges we've all struggled with in the last 5 years. So,
okay, thank you. Like the vice chair said, it's a very inspirational activity that you're engaged in. Thank you so much. Keep us posted. Come back. We'll figure out how to be as supportive as we can. So, thank you.
Thank you all very much. Yeah.